This morning, we will be talking with another speaker from a series called the Friday Forum. It has been going on now for a number of years. I think it may well be contender for the longest-running talk series on the University of Illinois campus. And this takes place at the University YMCA on Fridays. It's jointly sponsored by the Illinois Disciples Foundation, the McKinley Foundation, the University YMCA, and the Wesley Foundation. And there is a series in the fall and the spring, and every series is organized around a particular topic. And over the years, we have drawn on this series for guests. It has brought us some interesting folks and has given us the opportunity to bring them to an audience outside of Champaign-Urbana, folks who would not come here to hear the speeches on Fridays. Of course, it is free and open to the public, and anybody who would like to attend is welcome to do that. This series, I think, has some of the most interesting ideas contained in it, and yet it may be, the theme of the series may be one of the most difficult to try to explain in one or two lines. It is basically about taking a look at the sometime conflict between our humanity and the technology that surrounds us, and the ways in which technology has changed the way we think about who we are as human beings, and how, in fact, it may not always work to our advantage in preserving humanness, our humanness. And the guest for the program today is Professor Rajmohan Gandhi. He is currently a visiting professor of political science at the University of Illinois. He has spent he's spending this semester and was here in the fall teaching and giving talks. He's interested in a number of things. He has written on and done research on topics including the history of South Asia, Hindu-Muslim and relationships, and also the relationship between India and Pakistan, and more generally the subject of ethnic tension and their tensions and their resolution. He is research professor in the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi and has been associated with several research institutions in the United States. He has served in the upper house of the Indian Parliament. In 1990, he led the Indian delegation to the United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva. He has also written a biography of India's great leader Mahatma Gandhi, who was his grandfather. The title of the book, The Good Boatman, A Portrait of Gandhi. And we're pleased to have him come and spend a little time with us here on the program to talk about technology versus culture, the perspective from India. That is the topic of his talk that he'll be giving on Friday afternoon. So as we talk, you should feel free to be a part of the conversation. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
I think India should offer an interesting perspective because if there's any place where you see a coming together of modern culture and technology and very old culture, India is going to be the place, one place where you can look, a country that has given us two of the world's great philosophical systems. Today is also home to one of the cutting-edge industries of the modern technological world. Maybe we can just start talking about this this interesting convergence of realities that you have in India.
Yes, maybe I should start by talking about my own a relative discomfort with some aspects of modern technology, and this is not necessarily an Indian thing. Hmm. Let me speak about computers. I'm 63 years of age. I've started working on computers only in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. I was doing my books on a conventional typewriter. Now I work on computers, but I'm still sometimes frightened by what the computer can do. In the summer of 1995, or rather the spring of 95, I was in the United States for a few months as a visiting fellow, and I was given the chance to work on one of my books. And I was having a huge problem with the computer that was assigned to me. And I was really frustrated. I wasn't making any progress. I was losing my work. And so I said to a friend of mine, his name is Frank Blackman. He was with me in this place in Virginia, in Fairfax, Virginia, and George Mason University. And I said to Frank, look, I feel so frustrated, I feel like jumping out the window. Frank said to me, I understand your frustration, but instead of jumping out the window, why don't you chuck the computer out the window? I liked that because Frank reminded me that the human being was more important than the technology. And I think I've really understood that. And that helped me a lot. But I tell that story not just to relate technology to human beings, but also to point out that in my discomfort with computers, I'm really somewhat of an exception. As you hinted in your remarks, many Indians are wonderfully at home with computers. And in the software area, and generally in the computer area, Indians are as good as people in any other part of the world, and many of them are now in the United States. So I just wanted to make that introductory comment.
Well, it's certainly, it does seem that for all of the enthusiasm that we voice about technology, that a great many of us, maybe most people, are just not quite, are not sure about it. I think back to programs that we have done talking about computers, programs that began with the sometimes unstated idea that computers were wonderful, that they were going to do great things for us, that everybody should have one, and that we all should love them. And I recall occasionally having a few people calling in and saying, you know, I don't love them. I don't feel comfortable with them. Why do I need to have one? Huh. And that often we, you know, perhaps we don't treat people like that terribly well because we say, well, they're Luddites or they're technophobes. Uh-huh. And we say, sometimes we say, well, what's wrong with you? That you should even question this. This new technology, and whatever it is, going to be different technologies. It's wonderful. It's going to change your life. It's going to be great. After a couple of weeks, you will say to yourself, how did I ever get along without this? And actually, I think most people are saying, no, wait a minute. I'm not so sure about this. And early adopters sometimes, I think, grab us by the ear and lead us. And maybe sometimes that's good. But I think that the kind of discomfort with technology is probably quite widespread.
I was hugely relieved the other night on television to see a program on Ann Landers. Mm-hmm. And there she was in front of a large electric typewriter, not an electronic typewriter, but just an electric typewriter. And she has continued to churn out her columns on that typewriter. And that gave me a great deal of encouragement. However, let me say that I really now am finding the computer very, very useful indeed. Yeah. Maybe I should refer to one aspect of the technology-culture conflict relating to India. This is not a modern story. It's actually a 150-year-old story, but it's a very well-known story. Those, however, who have not heard it may find it still interesting, and I think it does explain the sharp conflict that sometimes can arise. Now, when the British were ruling India, that is from about 1760 until 1947, the British were importing into India technology. In the year 1857, there took place what the British call a mutiny and what many Indians call the Great Rebellion. And this took place in the Indian soldiers in the army that the British rulers had in India. And the mutiny was sparked off by the import of a new rifle, the Lee-Enfield rifle, and in particular by the ammunition that this Lee-Enfield rifle required. And this ammunition, these bullets, were cased parchment paper, stiff parchment paper. The bullet was kind of wrapped tight inside this, and the ends of the parchment at both ends were twisted. There was grease on this parchment, and the grease was necessary because you wanted the bullet to slide or slip into the gun before it could be fired. Of course, each bullet was separately loaded into the gun. And the soldier held the gun with the left hand and had this bag on his right where he had these bullets. And he would take a bullet out and with his teeth tear this wrapping open, half of it, and hold the bullet with the other half and slip the bullet into the gun. Now, this grease on the wrapping was made partly with beef tallow and partly with pork. And as you know, or as you may not know, in India, we have the great majority of the Hindus for whom beef is something that they cannot eat. The cow is a sacred animal. And for the Muslims who were at that time in undivided India, 25%, of course, pork was forbidden. And when you bit into the wrapping, you were actually eating what you were not supposed to eat, either the beef or the pork. And so you were polluting Indians out of their customs. And this was interpreted by many people as one deliberate act by the British to get Indians out of their caste, polluted out of their caste, and then to be converted into an imported religion, Christianity. And that sparked off the Great Indian Mutiny of 1857, which was a tremendous event. And there you had this great clash between imported technology and strongly believed local values, local culture.
Did the British think of that at all? Did this come as some surprise to them when they learned how the soldiers, both Hindu and Muslim, were reacting to this ammunition?
Within days, of course, they realized. At first, there were attempts to deny. Then there were attempts to replace the grease, which, of course, was possible. And I think within days, orders went out that another kind of grease should be used. But by this time, the damage had been done. It was too late. And they tried to explain that now it's different, but the people didn't believe it because suspicion had also entered into people's souls in a very deep way. So that they did try to, but the fact that they first tried to deny it and then tried to explain there had been a change, it created problems, and it didn't satisfy.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Raj Mohan Gandhi. He is an historian and political scientist. He's currently a visiting professor of political science at the University of Illinois. This week's speaker in the Friday Forum series, taking a look at empowering the human in a technological society. And he will be speaking on the topic technology versus culture, the perspective from India. Of course, questions, comments, welcome. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. I guess that serves as an example of unintended results when you try to take a piece of technology that comes with a certain set of values and insert it into a culture that has another set of values.
Yes.
And the fact that serious conflict can result.
Indeed. And maybe there's another aspect to which I might refer, which is that the technology versus culture question, sometimes, not always, of course, can also be seen as a conformity versus liberty question. Technology might suggest that everybody doing the same thing the same way, and culture might want a greater stress on individuality and each person doing it in a different way. The other day, I went to see this play by Fugard at the Station Theatre, The Road to Mecca. I don't know how many of those listening in would have seen this, but the story is about this lady, an older white woman in South Africa in the early 70s. And she lives in a remote part of South Africa in the countryside. And it's very difficult to get to the place. And it's a small area. Population around her is small whites as well as blacks. She's an artist, and she creates rather uncustomary things with concrete and with other things. She creates hybrid forms, half human, half animal. This is a very religious community. And what she creates is regarded with distaste by the others. It's certainly nonconformist, and it's very cultural, very individual. And she's attacked, and she's accused even of idolatry and things like that. And she calls her place kind of Road to Mecca, which again is rather unusual in white South Africa. And I went to this place with Professor Blair Kling, history professor here. He and I had co-taught a course in the fall of 97. And Professor Kling said to me as soon as he saw this, well, this reminds me of Chandigarh. Now, Chandigarh is a city in India built by modern concepts, by the French-born architect, designed by the French-born architect Corbusier. It's one of the great cities of India, very, very efficient in many ways. And when Kling looked at this play by Fugard and this lady creating this art of her own kind, he was reminded of a very unusual garden in the middle of the city in Chandigarh. This is designed by an Indian who was actually a bureaucrat to begin with, a very humble bureaucrat. It later is now known as a real artist, great artist. But what he did was to convert a dump in the middle of Chandigarh into a great garden. And he, a bit like this lady in the play, he used concrete, he used broken pottery, porcelain, stone, and has created, again, hybrid forms, half-human, half-animal, birds, human beings. He's created a most fantastic, natural, creative rock garden in the middle of this wonderfully modern city. And so there you have this debate between culture and technology, as you had in that play. And it comes across very much as kind of human freedom against crowding in of technology. Mm.
We have a caller to talk with, someone on a cell phone, so we should not make them wait. They're in Kansas, Illinois, line number 4. Hello. Is the caller there on line number 4? Well, apparently not. Maybe we lost them. Maybe they changed their mind. In any case, they could call back, or others can call 333-WILL or toll free 800-222-WILL. And if you match those letters with the numbers on the phone, you get 9455. So 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. But certainly India is a rapidly growing country and has the potential to be a great economic power. It is exploring modern industry. And we've talked about computers and computer software. And at the same time, as I said at the beginning, we have a culture that has goes back a very long time. Are there some ways in which you think that you can see technology that has come into India from outside? Has it begun to erode traditional culture?
Well, one great area where there's been a bitter conflict in India is over these large dams, where great rivers are diverted and water is captured, and large areas are emptied of people. People have to leave. And very often, the people who are obliged to leave because of these large dams are people who have been living for centuries on that piece of land. Now, India, too, like some other parts of the world, has a mix of what might be called a settled population and tribal populations. And some of these large dams in India have necessitated the displacement of tribal populations of India from lands to which they have been used customs for centuries. And this has led to enormous tensions and great controversies. And since often there's been funding from the whole world, the World Bank, so this has become also an international issue. It isn't easy to take a view one way or the other on this, because on the one hand, there is the right to habitat, a cultural right, almost a heritage. And on the other hand, there is what might be called the right to water for others, because if these great dams manage to take water to thirsty areas, and India also has those problems. So there's one very well-known controversy in the western part of India, in the state of Gujarat, where opinion is very sharply divided, and that those who feel that the displacement of the tribals is something absolutely unforgivable, and there are those who feel that if an honorable compromise can be made, and if, yes, there will be adjustment problems, tough problems, but if water can be taken to areas that haven't had the water, that is a worthwhile compromise. But that, of course, is probably the sharpest illustration of this conflict.
Well, let's try again for some other callers. We have some. These are local folks, starting on our line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question. I have noticed that among scholars, especially, there is this tendency of, you know, analyzing various cultures and subcultures without being judgmental, in the sense that without, you know, calling a technologically more advanced society better than somebody who is not technologically advanced. And nowadays, it's become very extreme. You know, you call a non-literate culture when they don't have a technology and things like that. So what I want to know is this necessary? I mean, is it necessary to be so non-judgmental when you're doing scholarly work?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. If you are implying that we should not hesitate to say that technology that can make us economically advanced, educationally advanced, literate should be welcomed, and that a society that is without literacy and without public health and without schools and roads is not a satisfactory society, I'd agree with you. I think that kind of judgment we must make. There's no hesitation in my mind on that whatsoever. I suppose what I'm trying to say is that when you are saying, yes, technology must be imported if need be, or applied if we have it locally, we must do it in such a way that we don't offend local cultures. And very often the price of offending local cultures is a tremendous clash and a disruption, and the whole thing is ground to a halt, as over the Narmada Dam in Gujarat. So I appreciate your point. I think we can't be technological. We can't say that there is no advantage to be gained out of technology. Of course there is.
Does that get at your question, or would you like to go further?
No, that's it. Thanks very much.
All right. Let's go to another call, line two, also locally here. Hello.
Yes.
Yeah.
My question is about the biodiversity issue. India is considered as a country with a very vast plant biodiversity, different kinds of crops. There is a discussion going on about seeds, hybrids, and major companies coming in, and the fear that the cultural heritage of a tremendous variety of food grains across India may be in danger. And there is the other side of it, which is the economic necessity for producing more food. Is this something that that can lead to a compromise solution? And is there any other comments that you might want to make on this issue? You may have handled this before, I don't know. I switched on the radio 15 minutes into your show, so maybe my question is redundant, but I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Well, your question is not redundant at all. It's being addressed for the first time, and I think it is a very important question. I have to admit right away that I am not an expert in biotechnology or in genetics, but the point you've made is important current issue in India, and it is there is a feeling that these imported plants or seeds or cells or forms of life might cause some indigenous plants and life forms to disappear for all time, so that the question is seen as technology versus heritage, as you indicated also. And I like particularly your suggestion that there could be some kind of compromise, because in a way that is the point that I was hoping to make towards the end of this conversation, that we need to develop in India particularly the culture of compromise. I think too often we have an all-or-nothing attitude. We must preserve the ancient traditional life forms which we've had for centuries, and therefore we must not have any of the modern biotechnology or plants or seeds. I think that's an extreme attitude. On the other hand, the attitude that, well, these things have worked so wonderfully in other parts, they will work in India, and let's import them without discrimination, without enough thought, and that could be equally dangerous. I have to concede that in India, very often the debate or discussion becomes very mutually hostile. I'm not knowledgeable enough to know exactly what should be done in this area. But I'm prepared to bet that there are many of these advances in biotechnology that could be of great help to India without endangering our heritage of species, life forms. Thank you very much.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of this conversation, and I probably should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Professor Rajmohan Gandhi. He is currently a visiting professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. He is research professor in the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi and has been spending some time here at the University of Illinois over the last few months teaching courses on Indian and South Asian history and politics. He has published a biography of India's great leader, Mahatma Gandhi, who was his grandfather. The title of the book is The Good Boatman, A Portrait of Gandhi. He has also written on the topic of Hindu-Muslim relations in India and is going to be the speaker this week in the Friday Forum series, talking about technology versus culture, the perspective from India. This spring, this series of noontime talks, looking at various aspects of the tension between humanity and technology. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. The caller and your comments bring to mind a recent conversation, fairly recent, that we had on this program with an anthropologist named Wade Davis. And we were talking about, he was talking about the fact that indigenous cultures around the world are disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily the fact that those people are disappearing, but they are losing their language, traditional ways of life that make them distinct. I think one of the things that he was encouraging people to do was to think about biological diversity more broadly. I think his point was that when we talk about preserving biological diversity, we talk about preserving plants and natural resources, and don't often think about culture as something that is worth preservation as well, and that there is some sort of value in having cultural diversity as well as diversity of plants and animals and ecosystems.
Well, languages and foods and works of art, of course. Sometimes I have to admit that it does appear as if, the Internet revolution, the technology and information technology revolution has to be accompanied, for instance, by the adoption of English as the sole language of the entire universe. And that would be a terrible tragedy. But, of course, the moment we stop and think, it doesn't have to be so at all. It looks like that. We know that the Chinese and the Russians and people in all parts of the world are rapidly trying to learn English. I think that if this goes unabated and we foolishly and unthinkingly allow the technological revolution to also mean enveloping the planet with the English language alone, I think that would be a mighty tragedy. But I think that technology will allow for Japanese and Chinese and Sanskrit and Arabic and Persian and Hebrew and may be indeed that all these wonderful treasures of language will be preserved better as a result of these possibilities. Mm.
Let's talk again with another caller. Number one, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I'm always careful to think of technology as just know-how. And we may know how to do a whole lot of things, but we don't necessarily have to do it. I was reading a book last night by that was written the year your grandfather died, 1948, and made me wonder what's going on as far as agriculture in India. This was about the Hunza Cuts. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's a group of people above Kashmir, east of Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole book was about basically the whole idea was that the Hunza Cats were extremely healthy and very, very hardy people.
Who lived to great ages.
Right. And I don't know if this is based in reality as much as it seems to be, but and that this gentleman that wrote this book attributed it all to organic farming. And he said that he thought that he made the argument that our commercial farmers today using chemical fertilizers are creating, disease in not only in plants but in people, and that made me wonder. Since you're an historian and interested in technology, I was wondering if how has India over the years, coped with the possibility of or the problem of quote technology and agriculture when they had such a good example in their own country of a more natural and yet very extremely effective way of life.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, the Hunza, the Hunza people, really are now in an area that is administered by Pakistan. You know, it is that part of Kashmir which is held by Pakistan. The Kashmir is held partly by Pakistan, partly by India. And so the Hunza people are in the Pakistan-administered area. Whether their longevity, their health has suffered as a result of modern technology and disruption of organic farming, I really don't know. So I really can't answer your question. I do know that all over India there is great concern about organic farming and chemicals and fertilizers. And it's also true that when modern ideas come and modern products come and are marketed very well and dazzlingly shown, they can very quickly sweep away some wonderful nature-preserved items. And I think that in general terms, that, of course, is a hazard we must be very vigilant about. But on the particular question of the Hunzas and how they are faring today, I have to say I don't know.
Okay. Well, then I guess I'll just mention something I just wanted to verify. Your grandfather was very skeptical of technology, I understand. He thought that, in particular, that as, and I'll hang up after this, he thought that comfort in no way was conducive to moral growth, for example, and... Mm-hmm. Correct. Is that correct?
It's partly correct. I would say that he certainly believed that self-restraint was the way for human beings. He was very cautious about Western industrialization and its impact on India, but he was not against industriousness. Indeed, he tried to popularize the spinning wheel in every part of India, and because he felt that women could work on it, and old men could work on it, and youngsters could work on it, and in some ways, it's possible to argue some very loyal followers, if you like, of Gandhi, argue that Today, the modern computer is the spinning wheel for our day and age, and it can be operated by individuals in their homes the way the spinning wheel could be. I think Gandhi sometimes used very exaggerated and sweeping language about modern technology, but he was also very much for a rise in the standard of living of the very poor people of India. I think we have to distinguish between his willingness to adopt a very stern and strict and austere life for himself and what he hoped for the Indian people. He thought that austerity on his own part would make him more effective as a leader of the Indian people, but he definitely wanted more comfort, more food, better housing, better health, better schooling for the Indian people.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Other comments, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Earlier in the program, the first part of the program, you told the story of the mutiny or rebellion, depending on which side you're on, of 1857. How it is that came about. Do you think that there is some piece of technology today that has the power to create conflict on that level, or have we become so comfortable with it and so relatively comfortable with it that such a thing, you can imagine a technology causing something like that now?
Well, just to remind any who might have not heard that opening bit about the 1857 events, you know, this was, of course, the bullet and the wrapping, the greased wrapping, yeah, and causing the Indian soldiers to bite into what could be beef, which was forbidden, or pork, which was forbidden for Muslims, and that led to this great mutiny in the soldiers. Yes, well, even recently, you know, take Rwanda, for instance, where the world has been exporting arms into Rwanda, or did until fairly recently. Many countries in Europe, even South Africa, and some other countries were involved in selling small arms today. Now, Rwanda and other parts of Africa may not have the culture forbidding them to eat either beef or pork, but they have a culture of antagonism. And if you import lots of firearms into that culture, then you have this incredible disaster situation. So I would say that those examples of 1857 are certainly not irrelevant for our day and age. Hmm.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, I'll introduce our guest. We're speaking with Professor Rajmohan Gandhi. He is a visiting professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, teaching history and the politics of South Asia. He is a research professor in the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi, and we're talking to him about some of the ideas he'll be raising in his talk in the Friday Forum series this Friday. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. It seems as if the theme for the series presupposes that technology has the potential to threaten our humanity, and that we perhaps have lost something, or may be well running the risk of losing something as a result of adopting new technologies.
Well, I suppose we have to recognize that it is the mix of new technologies and old enmities which really is the most dangerous thing. And here, your question reminded me of the nuclear tests of India and Pakistan in May of last year. So where you have a culture of antagonism or potential antagonism, and you have this, I wouldn't necessarily call it only imported technology, because our scientists and Pakistani scientists are pretty good at doing their own technology. But yes, a lot of it was imported knowledge. And so this modern technology now in South Asia, in today's age, is something that causes us to be very, very, very careful and vigilant. So, so there is, yes, technology has this tremendous hazard. It's not an unmitigated blessing, is it?
Mm. Let's talk again with another caller, locally, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had a question. Charge that has sometimes been leveled against technology is that it has deepened the divisions between the haves and the have-nots, especially in the poorer nations like India. It is as if the select few who are intellectually more advanced, they are taking a stranglehold on the minds and the lives of the vast majority. So do you see technology as an instrument in ushering in a meritocracy maybe, or does it have a more benign role as a great leveler of people and societies?
Well, that's, again, a great question. And I think it's more a suggestion for action than a question, because you're quite right that technology today has enabled, say, in India or in similar countries, the elite, the already successful, to become even more elite and even more successful.
Mm-hmm.
And successful Indians, for instance, have easily integrated into the world economy, but the poor Indian is yet to be integrated into the Indian economy. And so so that's what technology can do. I don't think it's the mistake in technology. I think it's a mistake in what might be called the commitment of the elite in countries like India. And technology has to be harnessed for greater equality, for greater leveling. Maybe one other way of looking at it is to recognize that technology has a very powerful, inherent, excluding character. Technology saves labor. It excludes people. And we've got to bring the culture of inclusion along with technology. And if we don't bring the culture of inclusion along with technology, technology can be a terrible menace, really, to poor countries. Does that?
Yeah, so do you see this happening, the poorer nations moving towards a more inclusion policy? Or
not sufficient. No, it isn't happening. Although, I mean, there is, of course, a trickle-down effect of some kind, even when the elite become more successful or richer. Some of it, a tiny percentage of it, does go even to the poor people, but that is by no means enough. There's got to be a very conscious and deliberate, determined policy to ensure that technology's benefits go to a much wider. And that sadly, is not being done enough.
Yeah.
So we need awareness for that. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I'm going back to the idea that you raised about one of the problems with technology being that it can take existing conflict and make it worse, or perhaps make it possible for people to inflict greater damage on one another than they could have before. That's perhaps a way of thinking about it that I hadn't, and that we tend to think of technology being problematic in and of it, well, itself. Yeah. And that we have to give at least as much credit to, or be at least as concerned with the how conditions as they are between people before we talk about what happens with imported technology. That in a sense it only amplifies or magnifies what exists already.
I think that's perhaps a valid point, and I would subscribe to that. In other words, what you're suggesting is that the real problem is not technology per se, but maybe the existing antagonisms, the existing... I think there's much there. And these antagonisms need to be tackled. So when we talk about technology and culture, yes, we've got to have appropriate technology for a given culture, but maybe we also have to think of appropriate cultures. And that is, of course, a tougher task. How to bring about a change in culture. Now, in India particularly, I mentioned the idea of compromise, you know, between those who take extreme positions. Just now, the government has announced in India a great plan for national superhighways in north to south, east to west. But that requires using up forests in many areas, in some cases maybe using up land regarded as very precious or sometimes even sacred or very... natural habitat for certain people. There will be so many others who will want to hold on to their bit of land for economic reasons. But we have a great culture of litigation. We have a great culture of conflict. We have a great culture of fighting. And unless those things are overcome, these wonderfully planned superhighways will never see the light of day. There'll be a huge conflict. So it's not a question of technology alone. It's probably more so a question of, as you've put it, existing cultures. And what is to be preserved must be preserved. What is to be modified must be confronted and changed.
Mm. We have a caller here in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Namaste.
Namaste.
In the world of technology, finance is certainly the head of everything. It seems to be the tail that wags the dog, and cultures aside, the heads of the financial empires, as we recently witnessed a huge conference in Switzerland, which had in attendance all the heads of the different governments, mm-hmm. including India, and the CEOs of the prominent corporations. And they felt that the conditions in the world, at least in terms of finance, were very, very volatile. And certainly the United Nations Secretary General in his end of the year conference spoke about those things. But I feel that India, it can be an exemplar to other countries in its neutrality that it for many long times has been demonstrated. And I only wish that the peace that was in the heart of your grandfather and all the other great saints can be reflected in our lives. And I just thought I'd mention that. But I have another question relating to communication. As I understand it, Meher Baba had communicated through his mandali to your grandfather prior to his death that he should cease continuing his actions at a day or so before and come with him. And your grandfather declined to do so. So I thought I'd call you up and mention those things.
Thank you. I'm not myself aware of this last point you mentioned. I know that my grandfather did have a high regard for Meher Baba, but about this reported communication between the two, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of that. Thank you for your points anyway.
Well, I also wanted to bring out the area of finance, which seems to be having a stranglehold on the different ability of countries to maintain themselves or just completely subordinate themselves and result in extreme measures, you know, which further depress the population's capacity to thrive.
Well, the volatility of finance has definitely damaged many a country in Asia, and that's... I think the technology of finance needs an enormous amount of improvement because it has the capacity within a few days to really destroy whole economies. So I'm glad you made that point.
And I'm sure India would thrive regardless of the Y2K. Thank you.
All right. Well, at that, we must stop because we're here at the end of the time. If you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from our guest, Rajmohan Gandhi. He'll be speaking at the Friday Forum this coming Friday, tomorrow, at a little bit past noon. And the programs are all free and open to the public. Anybody who would be interested in is invited to attend. This is at the University YMCA, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll continue perhaps taking up some of these themes. At least we'll be talking about the economy of Asia in the next part of Focus 580, focusing specifically on Japan. And there our guest will be Koji Taira. He is an emeritus professor of economics here at the University of Illinois.